So you want to avoid something of this form. There's all sorts of different abstract, you know, Cartesian products. So you have to think of some kind of property that's simple, that every Cartesian product has, but your set does not have. Okay. So, if your set, here's a kind of the simplest example I could think of would be, thank you, two-point set. You have homework for me?
Yeah.
Awesome. Simplest example would just be two points that don't make a horizontal or vertical line. I mean, you can't do it with one point. One point in the plane is a Cartesian product of two one-point sets. Right? But if you have a two-point set, then you're good. Right? So make your set, I don't know, let's call it E. It's just got these two points. And this is not a Cartesian product, right? Because if you had AB and CD elements of some other Cartesian product, I don't know, call it F times G, right? Then think about what that means. A Cartesian product, it just says the first coordinate is in the first set, the second coordinate is in the second set. Right? So then the problem is, if you have these two points, then you also have to have this point and this point. Right? You have to have, I guess, C, B, and A, B, A, D. Right? If you have these two points in some Cartesian product, then that means A and C are in F, and B and D are in G. But if you have that, then you get these two other points thrown in. So in particular, A is in F, and D is in G. So A, comma D would be in F product G. Or F times G, whatever you want to call it. Okay, so what does this show? So this shows that if E is a subset of some Cartesian product F times G, then E does not contain it, right? Because anything that contains E also has to contain the point A, D. But A, D is not an E. So anything big enough to contain E is strictly bigger than E. So that means E is not a Cartesian product. That's the simplest example I could think of. And that only requires two points. The only real requirement here, of course, is A better not be C and B better not be D. Right? It's kind of implicit in my picture, but if you're writing it down, I would, like I am here, I'd make it explicit. So, I mean, you just go with your intuition. And you probably get something like this. You might not get like the simplest thing that I came up with here. Maybe you thought, okay, I'll have three points. And then if they were all in a Cartesian product, the fourth point would have to be in there. Right. It occurred to me that you actually only just need two points like this. And already that, if you don't put anything else, then that's it. So that's probably an optimal solution of 1.5 number 4. Any other comments or questions? So, have you all read all of chapter 1? Maybe. I do want you to read the book. I tried to pick as gentle a book as I could, and I think you really will benefit from reading it. The new stuff today is, if you looked at the syllabus schedule, you see that we're on section 2.1 and 2.2. So far, I'm keeping up with the syllabus. I haven't told you every word that's in the book and lecture, because you can read. But I try to cover things that I feel the book is leaving out and I really want to say, or if there's an important idea in the book that I feel needs a little bit more than what the book did, or I just really want to emphasize its importance, I'm going to talk about it. So if you've read all the way through section 2.2, great, you're on top of things. We're going to talk about 2.1 and 2.2 today. So this is going to be due day 7 when I get back. This is today. Day 7 is like February 11th? Or is it February 10th? I think it's the 10th. So Wednesday? Yeah. It's the 11th. Mm-hmm. And Monday. What?
Thank you.
You've got a smartphone. You probably know. Yeah. Okay. It's the second Wednesday in February. My flight will get back on Tuesday. No, it gets back on Monday evening, February 9th. Yeah. So it's getting in just a little bit too late for me to teach the class. So I'll have to do a video lecture for that. I've been looking at the technology of it, and I'm going to do what I did a few years ago, essentially, which is I record the video, and then I just put it on YouTube, and so I'll just send you a link when the videos are ready. It seems to be the easiest way to do it. But that Wednesday, I'll be able to teach the class in person again. So let's look at 2.1, number 3, and 2.2, number 679. For your homework. And then I have a little graduate level problem of my own design. Okay. So say you have a set of reels, and consider the following property. We say a set of reels is well ordered if every non-empty subset of W has a minimum. Okay. That's the definition. And I want you to prove that if W, a subset of R, is well ordered, then I want you to prove W is countable in the following way. Prove that there's an injection from W to the rationals. An injection, Kroom prefers the term one-to-one function, although when he gives the definitions, I mean, he does at least mention injection at first, but then he likes to call them one-to-one functions, which are not to be confused with one-to-one correspondences, which are bijections. So this 2.1 is about, is basically it's about the reals and their ordering. Right? And 2.2 is about it's mostly about countability. Countability is the first level of infinity. There's the so-called countably infinite sets. And the reals are at a higher level of infinity, as we'll see. But first, before you can even prove something like that, we have to talk about some basic facts about how the reals are ordered. And there's some key properties about how the reals are ordered. So the rationals, right, remember these things, I think if you do something like this, you can eventually, you can list all the rationals in some way. I think I've got all the rational numbers that involve zeros, ones, twos, and threes. If I need to make a new rational, there's more rational numbers, but I think they would all involve integer natural numbers like four or larger. I'm missing the thirds. I suppose I could do mixed fractions, do one and a third to avoid the four thirds. But anyways, the rationals, you know what they are. Fractions are formed by integers. And so an important thing is that between any two reals x less than y, there is some rational number strictly between them. If you wanted to get fancy in your terminology, you would say something like the rationals are order dense in the reals or something. But the idea is between any two reals, there's a rational. And the other key property you need about the reals is that Let's say I have a set of reels A, and A is not empty, so there's at least one reel in the set, and then I need an, then I have the following property, and A is bounded above, then A has a least upper bound. Okay? Now what does bounded above mean? That should be easy, right? It just means it has an upper bound. And the only confusing thing there is that usually if you're drawing the number line from left to right, then upper bound is right bound. But we could write this out. Here's one way to think about it. This means that there exists a number U such that A is a subset of the interval. It's an infinite. Maybe I should call it an infinite ray or something. There's something that's greater than or equal to everything in A. If you make a picture, you know, if you want to have it really be above A, then you have the idea of okay, there's some stuff at various points on the number line that's in A. Okay. And then there's some number U such that A is less than or equal to, every point in A is less than or equal to U. And then a least upper bound would just be you shrink U down as much as you can. To say that, say, S is the least upper bound of A means that A is indeed bounded above by that S. And if you have any other upper bound, like this, then that upper bound is not any tighter than S already is. Right? So if A goes up to here, then the best upper bound, the one that gets as close to A as possible, would be S. That's as low as you can get while still being an upper bound. There can be lots of upper bounds, but the nice property of the real numbers is that if there's an upper bound, then you can, if it's not already as good as possible, you can shrink it down to something as good as possible. The rationals are not like this. If you don't have all the irrational numbers, then you run into problems, right? Because you think of a bad set like this. The set of all Q rational where Q squared is less than 2, right? So here's your rational line, and here, and the problem is B is going to be an open interval of stuff, right? All the rationals between the reals positive and negative root 2. The problem is this is irrational. That's not a rational number. So you can have lots of rational upper bounds, but there's no best upper bound in the rational, right? Okay. But let's say I have some number here, I don't know, X, right? So if I have my set B here, and there's some real x that's above b strictly, right? So let's suppose, you know, so if we have a rational upper bound, then that rational upper bound is actually going to be strictly above root 2, right? Because it's rational, so it can't be exactly root 2. And it can't be less than root 2, because then it wouldn't be an upper bound of b, right? If x was down here as a rational number, you could find something a little bit higher that was still rational and less than root 2. So maybe I can write that out a little bit more. Right? It's not equal to root 2. And it's not less than root 2, since if it were, that would imply, remember I said between any two reals there's a rational, so if you believe that, then you would believe that you'd have something like this. Right? If x was actually down here under root 2, then there'd be a y also under root 2 but above x. But then that would falsify the claim here that x is above everything in b. Actually, even if you just had the weaker version that just x is greater than or equal to everything in b, still, now it's not true anymore. There's something in B that X is not greater than or equal to, that Y. So you can't have X less than root 2, because then you won't bound all the rationals less than root 2. And so it's not exactly root 2, because that's an irrational number. It's not less than root 2, because it's supposed to be an upper bound of all the rationals less than root 2. Because of that problem is that you can't fit it under root 2, because you'd have a y up there that's rational. And so the only remaining possibility then is it's greater than root 2. It's not less than, it's not equal to, so it's greater than. So that means there's actually, since these are reals, there's a rational between them. Okay? So if I have my x right here, I can do a little better with some other rational number z. Okay? So for any rational number that's above my set B, there's always a strictly lower rational number also above my set B. So there are lots of rational upper bounds of this set, which is non-empty, of course, but there's no best one. If you want the best upper bound of this set of reals, you need an irrational number. You need root 2. Okay? And it's in this order theoretic sense that the rational numbers are full of holes. Okay? There's all kinds of holes like this. In fact, you can prove that between any two rational numbers, there's an irrational number. So whenever you have one of these numbers, that's basically a hole in the rational line. Okay. Now, between any two rational numbers, there's another rational number. So you can't really see the holes, because there's always rational numbers very, very close together. So they don't look any different, in some sense. But maybe you should think of it as the rational numbers are a thinner string or something, right? Maybe they should be a lighter shade of black on the board, because they really are full of holes, like Route 2. Have you all seen a proof that Route 2 is irrational?
That's standard fare.
Okay. Most of you acknowledge that you have. That's ancient knowledge, you know, thousands of years old. It's not essential in this course to know how to prove that. That's more of a number theory thing. You can look up a proof on Wikipedia or just about anywhere. It's very common. So we have kind of these two key properties here. They're visually speaking, they seem true, right? If I've got a set of reels all below U, then I can just push U down until I hit my set of reels, and I can't go any further, right? Well, seems intuitively true. You might wonder though if my picture is not capturing, you know, some kind of essential, you know, problem. You know, maybe there's some weird kind of set that would break this, just like my weird set here kind of broke things for the rationals. And you also might wonder about my claim here about between any two reals there's a rational. These things are often taken as like axioms, like you just say, okay, whatever the real numbers are, they better have these properties, otherwise I don't want to work with them. They're not my real numbers, they're something else. Right. That's often the approach. I'll say a little bit about why you should believe this. I'll talk about how the things work if you think of the real numbers in terms of decimal expansions. It's not quite a formal proof unless you formally define the reals in terms of decimal sequences. But I think it's a convincing argument, and so it's close enough. So first, what about the density in the order theoretic sense of the rationals? Between any two reals, there's a rational. That one's pretty easy, right? Okay, that's the fancy word for between any two reals, there's a rational, right? So if I have reals x and y, if you think of them as decimals, then find the first decimal place where they differ, and there are some little annoyances with the decimal representation, so this isn't quite enough. The problem is you could have things like 4.99999999 forever and 5.00000 forever, and those are considered the same real. Okay. So if they're actually different reals in the then they should have decimal representations that are not like that. So you want to choose the first decimal place where they differ. So if they're truly different reals, you might have something like 4.99999 and 5.00000, but that can't go on forever. They'd be the same real. Okay?
So
So like, I'm trying to illustrate like kind of a really bad case here. Maybe. Well, let's see. Yeah. Okay, here's something really bad. Okay, so here's where they differ. Okay. But if they're actually distinct reals, then eventually you'll have to see something else where it's not just zeros and nines. Okay, so eventually something maybe this one is a nine again here, but then this one is a two. Or it could have been this was a zero, but that one was an eight. Okay. So first you find that, okay, and then find the next decimal place so that would be part two there, where y is not 0 and x is not 9. Okay, so I'm trying to show you like the worst thing that could happen. Right, now we know that if they're the same until you get to, let's see, I don't think I did this right. Let me see. This should be y is supposed to be bigger, so this should have been more like. Supposed to fix that. Maybe, I don't know, 7, 7, 7, 7, 7, 7, 6. Okay, there we go. Okay, sorry for my careless ways here. All right, there. Okay. So that's where they first differ, but then maybe something really bad happens, beyond that. All right. Okay. But eventually, it can't just be the 9 and 0 business forever. Otherwise, it'd be the same reals. And so when you finally get to here, when you finally get to a true witness that they're actually different reals, then to make this rational, just truncate and increment. Okay? If you have a finite decimal expansion, then you're rational. In my example here, the z I'd get in between would be 44.17827769999999. Oh, but then I got an increment, so that goes up to a zero, so I have to carry zeros, and so those all become zeros, and this becomes a 7. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Okay. Fortunately, they're all zeros, so it doesn't matter exactly how many there are. Anyways, the point is there's a 2 there, so this really is less than... let's see. Okay. And... there's one little... Now, this is why I don't like the decimal representation. There's all sorts of little gotchas. Technically, this might actually be the same as x, because these nines could go on forever. Okay? So, if you want to be extra... So, if you want to avoid that possible noise, you have to increment that place, not by one, but by one half. So, okay. So you just
sure I got this right, by, not one half, but by three halves, right? You want to add a teensy bit more, okay? We know that this thing, this by definition, we chose a place where it's not 9 and 0, so I can increment this all the way out to here, right? And then I've got a little breathing room, because if this is actually a 9 here, then this is not a 0. It's at least a 1, okay? So if I put out another half in that place, so I get a 5 one place over, then even if that was a 1, I'm still safe here. Right? Because that last half is a little bit over there. And this one is just truncating, you stop. So it's actually kind of tedious to actually try and prove these things using the decimal root, using the decimal representation, because of all these 999 issues. But if you're careful, you can deal with it. And what about, you want to believe in this least upper bound property? Well, you can take this geometric intuition of push down U until you hit A, and you can do a decimal version of it. It's not too hard. At least it's not too hard if you don't ask for something super rigorous. Okay. Actually, carefully proving everything in terms of the decimal representations, you're going to run into similar little gotchas like this that you have to be careful about. But here's kind of a decimal-esque argument for you. So given non-empty A, subset of the reals, and some upper bound for A, okay? So this is just my little abbreviation here. It just means everything in set A is less than or equal to U, right? It's just a little abbreviation. So here's how I could turn that geometrical push the bound down until you hit A into a decimal algorithm here. So given a non-empty set with an upper bound, let's round U up to the nearest integer. And we'll call this, what should we call it? I'll call it S0. So this is kind of like, I rounded it up, so I still have an upper bound, because I might have made it a worse upper bound. But that's okay, because because this is, maybe U is really complicated. I've simplified things, and I just have an integer. So I've made my starting place simple. And now I'm going to push this simpler thing down towards A. All right? Okay. So, but I didn't say this was a good upper bound. I mean, it could be that everything in A is less than negative 30, and U is positive 1,010. And so it could be that I have to go a long way down until I hit A, right? So here's what you do. We have an integer now, so let's just subtract 1, okay? Subtract 1 from S0 repeatedly. Until we get some integer S1, that is still an upper bound, but if we subtract 1 more, were not an upper bound, right? A is non-empty. So if we keep subtracting 1, eventually there's going to be something in A that we're going to fly right past as we keep subtracting 1, right? If negative 52 is in A and U was, 1,010, we keep subtracting 1, eventually we're going to get less than negative 52, right? So if we fly past something in A, then we just, we went too far, take a step back. And so that's where we stop. So now we know that we can't go any further in terms of integer increments. All right. Okay. So now we're thinking decimals, so now we do it in tenths. All right. We know that if we subtract 10 tenths, we'll have gone too far. So after subtracting at most 9 tenths, we've gone as far as we can go. Okay. Okay. And then you can probably guess what's going to happen next, right? Hundredths, then you're going to do a thousandths. Okay. So you to get S2, we just subtract anywhere from no tenths to 9 tenths, such that that was the most tenths we could take away before we'd be under something in A. Right? It could be that S1 is already so close to A that we can't subtract any tenths. In which case, S2 will just be S1. Or it could be that we're almost 1 too high, so we can subtract 9 tenths and still be greater than or equal to everything in A. But 10 tenths would be too far because we stopped S1... being the best integer. S1 is the best integer upper bound of A. Now we've got the best, this S2 here is the best upper bound of A that's an integer multiple of a tenth. And we repeat the process with hundredths, subtracting anywhere from 0 to 9 hundredths to get the best upper bound that's an integer multiple of a hundredth. Right? And... And you can repeat this process with thousandths, ten thousandths, hundred thousandths, millionths, and so on. Okay? And you'll notice that... that this sequence is getting stable, right? I mean, once you get to S1, the furthest you drop after that is 9 tenths. And the furthest you drop after S2 is 9 hundredths. And the furthest you drop after S3 is to S4 is 9 thousandths and so on. So these things are getting closer and closer together. And you want to say something like, just read off the nth decimal place from Sn or something like that. That might not quite work because... when you subtract, you have to borrow, and that messes up earlier decimal places. So you, when you're thinking about this, you actually have to. Think about it. It's kind of annoying. Let me try and illustrate the process. You actually have to think about the one where you went a little bit too far. Okay. So let's say that 47 was too far. So 48 is an upper bound, but 47 is not. Okay. Well, that means that S1 is 48, okay? So, okay. So that means with this S2 here, the furthest we're going to go is down to 47.1, because 47 is no good. So this is, so how far do we go with this thing? It's going to be 47 point something, right? Okay. So maybe it's 47.3. And if it's 47.3, that means that S2 is must have been 47.4. So this was when you went too far. And then you go a little further on this one, and you'll have, say, 47.3. Where do you stop? And you stop at 47.35. So that means... But, so 3.35 is too far, and this is where you quit. And then maybe S4 is actually 47.359, which would mean from S3 to S4, you actually couldn't subtract any thousandths, because subtracting even one thousandth would make you too low to be an upper bound. Okay, so you can see here that... there's kind of a little bit of instability in that a digit here can change, right? And so you might be a little, you could be a little worried about that, like, and you might not, you might have to wait a long time for it to change. So, like, let's say that the next one was 0.3598. So that would mean here we had, I can make it even more, 3.957. So then we have here 47.3.598. So you could even have a bad thing like this digit, the first iteration after this digit didn't change, but then another iteration later it did change, right? So who knows how long you have to wait before one of these could change on you. Right. It gets a little bit annoying, but the digits over here are stable. Okay? All these digits are locked in. They never change. Okay? So the digits of these numbers these are the least upper bound. Okay? So in our example, the least upper bound of A would be the 47.3597, okay? Now, see, like this number is a teensy bit too low, right? But if necessary, all the following digits after this could be nines, right? If this is already the least upper bound, then all the digits after this will just end up being 9, so that it'll actually equal that. If this is not the best upper bound, then it won't be 9s forever. Eventually there'll be something less than a 9, because we can actually get lower than this. Either this will be all 9s because we already got as good as it'll get, or it won't be all 9s because we can do better. But in either case, these digits will be the least upper bound. But you see, you have to do a bunch of careful thought about when do digits change, when are they stable. The nice thing here is these are stable. I didn't write out a formal proof of all that, but that's the decimal idea. And if you don't believe the decimal idea, go back to the geometric idea. Push your upper bound down until you hit the set, and then stop. Okay. So those are the fundamental properties of the reals that we need for this course, is that you can have rationals in between reals, which mean, and
that you have this least upper bound property, which has a mirror image known as the greatest lower bound property. Right? If your set is non-empty and has a lower bound, you can push up with better and better lower bounds until you hit your set. And you could cook up a corresponding decimal algorithm for that.
Comments? Yes?
I think the digits should be S1, S2, S3, S4.
You want to use... You think the digits of the least upper bound will be from here?
Yes.
Well, you have to be careful about what you mean by that, because sometimes they conflict with each other. Like here, there's a 4 in the tens place, and then it changes to a 3. Okay? So, in the end, if you're careful, you have to make up extra rules to say, if there's a conflict here, you have to say, okay, I'll choose the later value. But yes, you can do it that way. As long as you just remember whenever there's a conflict to go with whatever it eventually stabilizes at, right? In this example, this 4 turns to a 3, but after that, it never is going to drop down to a 2, because after the 3 came a 6, and the lowest the 6 can drop down ever is to a 5, so we're not going to have a 3-0 drop to a 2-9, right? But you have to be careful, like with this 6 here, right, you know, You have to know the whole computation to know that, oh, eventually that 6 changes to a 5, right? So you would have to say, if you wanted to avoid the minuses, you would have to say something like the stable digits of S1, S2, S3, right? So like after they stop changing, right? Then it's fine.
How many S1 minus 1?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's less than 1 inch of a bit.
Well, but I mean, put them all together.
Okay.
Use all the digits. Put all the digits together. Right. All of these numbers are too low. But they're too low by a very small amount. If you just made this one a tiny bit bigger, it would be an upper bound, right? And so, but how much is the tiny bit bigger that makes it the best upper bound? You might not need to add this much. Maybe you can get by with a little bit less. And if you just keep reading out more digits from this sequence on the left side here, you'll get exactly however much you need to add to be the least upper bound. Yeah. It's kind of confusing, as I said, because the decimals make things annoying, basically. My intuition says go with these, but if I go with these, I have to remember that sometimes the decimals will change, because when you subtract stuff, you might have to borrow. Right, which is why you get like the 4 changes to a 3, the 6-0 changes to a 5-9. So you have to wait for things to stabilize. If you're careful, you can prove that although something might change once, it won't change twice. You can prove that at least. So you can prove that it'll either never change or it'll only change once. But you do have to be careful, you know, to say, use the stable digits. Like the 4 is stable, the 8 is not stable, the 7 is stable, the 3 is stable, the 6 is not stable, but the 5 is stable. So for sure, you know, it's going to be 4, 7, 3, 5. And then once I see that 8, I know the 9 is stable. Because the worst thing that happens is the 8 goes down to a 7 by borrowing later. The geometrical version is kind of, you know, you think about it this way, you know, here's A. You think about it as we were going down by increments of an integer, and then boom, you know, we went too far. And then we're saying, okay, go down by increments of tens. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. So if you've got a little bit of A there, and here, and here. And then you'd want to zoom in on this little subinterval and go down from S2 by increments of 100 until you went too far.
Right.
So basically this sequence is a sequence of approximations of the least upper bound from above. This sequence is a sequence of approximations of the least upper bound from below. But they both converge to the least upper bound. And there's actually a whole nother problem here. In that there could be a sign change. If I had chosen an example where these were negative numbers, then I actually would have had these be the stable and these be the unstable, right? So if we were talking about the negatives, you would actually have to use that. So yeah, see, the decimal representation has all sorts of little gotchas, little traps. That's why it's not fun to write out a rigorous proof of that. Because you have to deal with all these different cases of how the decimal representation works slightly differently. And if you're in the negative case, subtracting a tenth is more like adding a tenth. I think the geometric intuition is always going to be the most convincing thing to me. I can just push it down and I stop. So I can't go any further. Okay. Now let's talk about then this business of countability. Okay? So a set is finite if there is a bijection f from a to n or some natural number n. Okay? Well, I guess it depends on whether you include zero in the natural numbers. Maybe let's just say for a number that's a whole number, okay? For some whole number n, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, okay? Right? So that's our intuition of finiteness. Something's finite if you can actually, you know, count it and get done in finite time, right? Let's see. Maybe I should write it more carefully. But I get caught up with there's kind of a set theoretic definition of the natural numbers in which what I wrote a moment ago would have made sense, but this makes more sense, okay? So we have a bijection. In this case, the bijection for the set 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So that'll be our definition of finite. Okay. Okay. Something's finite, you ought to be able to count it and get done counting it. But there's another concept which says you can count it, but you never finish. Okay?
Set
A. How many different letters? Set B is countably infinite if there is a bijection. And I guess if you want, you can have the bijections go the other way. But anyways. You can just take the inverse and have the bijection go the other way. It doesn't matter, right? Bijections have inverses, which are bijections. And I think we call the net. I think our natural numbers start with 1 in this course. You can tell me if they think they should start with 0. Okay. So this is a little different now. So we kind of count things. I mean, everything. There's infinitely many things in B. But for any particular element, like say that element, if I wait long enough, I eventually count it. Okay? So if I think of it as a finite, if I think of it as a process, I count this one, then that one, and that one, I never get done. But for any particular thing in B, eventually I get there. I eventually get to it. Okay? So it's almost finite. Right? If you wait long enough, you can get as much of B as you want. For any particular element, you'll eventually get it. You'll never have everything, but whatever you want, you'll get it eventually. Okay. So it's the next best thing to find out. And a lot of times you have some kind of argument that works for countably infinite sets, and if it turns out your set is finite, you just stop at some point, and the argument still works even though you sort of stopped early. Right? So it's often convenient to handle both of these situations at once. So you have the concept of a set is countable if it is finite or countably infinite. There's a bunch of nice facts that you can prove about countable sets. Your book has a lot of them. And if this idea here of trying to count something up, and the idea is, well, you may never get done, but for any particular element, you get to it eventually. If you take that intuition, you can show things like the following. If P and Q are countable, then their Cartesian product is countable. Right? How do you prove that? Well, the kind of the easy picture is you imagine the Cartesian product. So here's P. Let me have X. Let's do the traditional way with X to the right. Okay, so here's P. P is going off forever that way. And Q is sort of going up further this way. I mean, you can think of them as each copies of the natural numbers, right? And the bijection, take a bijection like this and go backwards to sort of get a copy, and that's your copy function. It takes the natural numbers to a copy Q and a copy P. Except I said countable, right? So maybe these are finite. Maybe Q actually stops there, but it doesn't matter. The point is, now, if you look in the Cartesian product, you can cook up lots of different ways to handle a grid of points like this, such that maybe you never get done because maybe it's infinitely tall or infinitely wide or both. But nonetheless, you can cook up a strategy such that everything will get counted eventually. Maybe you start here, and so I'm going to start here, then I go here, so I count this one first, then this one, then I go here, then I count this one, then I go here, then I count this one, then I count this one, then I count that one, then I count that one. There's lots of ways that you could make sure that eventually everything gets counted. You could just continue that strategy, for example. Just keep going like that. If one of these turns out to actually be finite, maybe Q actually stops at that level. So I get here and then I've run out. Well, okay, no problem. I'll just make a big, if necessary, I can just make a big skip and come back over here. Right? If there was nothing more up here, then I can make a big skip and then just sort of snake up and down like this. If, say, Q was finite but P was infinite. But in any case, you can cook up things like that so that everything gets covered eventually. A similar thing is, say you had a whole bunch of sets and they're all countable. Then their union, right? So union them all up together, is countable. And it's basically the same picture, because you can think of the same kind of grid, right? Here's my P1, here's my P2. It's possible there's actually some overlap between P1 and P2. So if necessary, only put here the dots that are in P1, or in P2, but not already in P1. And then here would be P3, at least all the stuff that isn't already covered in P1 union P2. It goes on. Any of these columns could be either finite or countably infinite. And then, of course, you'd have P4 minus all the stuff that is already in the first three columns. But you can do the same game as you did there. Start here, and then go around like this. To make sure you count everything. Everything gets covered eventually. Right? The book has some of these things written up in proofs. It has at least one similar picture of a similar strategy. And the last thing I want to talk about in relation to this is that the reals are not countable. Okay. So that's what I said earlier. The reals are at a higher level of infinity. The rationals are countable, right? I had basically a listing, or at least a prototype for how you might list all the rationals on the board earlier, right? I said, start with like 0, 1, negative 1, then do the halves and 2, then do the thirds and 3s. You can basically do that kind of snaky strategy with the rationals. Or some other strategy, but you can think about it. There are ways to list the rationals such that every rational eventually gets listed. Okay, there's lots of ways to do it. The interesting thing is that R is not countable. The way you show that is you show that if you had any purported listing of the reals, you can mess it up, right? Or you can show that it's missing something, right? This is how you show something. This is a standard way of showing something not countable. So suppose I have a list of reals, okay? Then I claim there exists some real y, how about in the unit interval from 0 to 1, that is different from all of those. So that means I can't list the reals like I can list the rationals. Now, if I start up any listing of the reals, then even after I've listed infinitely many things, I'm still not done. Right? So that it's a higher level of infinity. You can't approximate the reals by finite lists the way you can approximate the set of natural numbers or the set of rational by finite lists, right? If you start listing out reals, there'll be some things where there's an infinite weight before you get to it. And to list all the reals, you'd have to go beyond, you know, counting by natural numbers. You'd need things called ordinals that could take you further. Okay. So how do you do this? Well, picture's worth a thousand words. The book goes through an argument. And here's how I think of the picture. I think of here's 0 and 1. Okay. There's a number of ways you can do it, but the standard idea is a kind of a bisection argument, right? Okay. So just look at this list and wait until some xn actually hits our set. Okay. Eventually, one will. And I guess to make the argument slightly faster, instead of bisection, why don't I avail myself of slightly more pieces? Okay. So maybe none of them are in this interval. In which case, this is easy. If we never hit this interval, then we didn't list all the reals. Okay. So wait until something actually arrives. This is supposed to, if this is really going to be a list of all the real numbers, then we should eventually get something in there. It could be at the endpoints or it could be in the interior. Right? Then choose a third of this thing that avoids xn, right? So you can, by that I just mean one of these. So one of these closed intervals. Just pick one. If I have one point, it can't possibly be in all three of the intervals at once. It could be in two of the intervals at once, but it can't be in three of the intervals at once, right? So even if my xn was right on the boundary point here, I could still avoid it by just picking that one. Okay? And then you call this third, I guess it's our first one, so we'll call it A1, B1. So maybe we pick this to be our A1, B1 here. And then we wait until we can call this, N1, I guess. It's our first N where we get a hit. Wait until some, you know, XN2 is in this interval, right?
We know that nothing before this one was in this interval because this was the first thing between 0 and 1 at all. So nothing before this would have been in this smaller interval. Okay? But maybe if we wait longer, something will appear that is in there. Okay? Okay. If we wait forever, then that means our list missed everything in the interval. So anything in here can be the y. But if eventually something does appear, then choose a third to avoid this new little annoyance here. Right? Okay, so we can easily pick a third here. I don't know which one we pick. Maybe we pick. So we cut into thirds, and we just pick one that avoids it. So maybe this will be A2B2 here. Right? Maybe this one will avoid. Right? And you just repeat, okay? And you just do this forever, and anytime a real from this list shows up, we shrink our interval to avoid it. And the result is that the least upper bound of all of those A's will be the same as the greatest lower bound of all of those B's, right? Because the intervals keep shrinking by a factor of 3. So if this actually goes on forever, right? If shrinking by a thirds doesn't eventually get us to an interval that avoids the whole list, then in the end, the intervals will shrink down to a point, right? Right? The A ends and the B ends will get closer and closer together, right? And in the limit, they'll end up being the same. They'll hit some common real. And this point will be in all of those intervals. And so it will not be any of these x's. Because if it were one of those x's, then that would have been an x that hit one of these intervals, and then our interval would have avoided it. Right? So each one of these intervals does the job of avoiding a bunch of stuff. Right? x1, x2, all the way up to xn(1). Right, are not in the first interval, right? And then x1, x2, all the way up to x(n)(2), right? Wait a little longer until we get a hit that might actually be in there. But then this interval avoids all those. And then we get a smaller interval that avoids even more of them, right? So you have something, the y, right, that's in all of them. So each of these intervals avoids more and more stuff on the list. And the y will be in all the intervals because it's greater than or equal to all the a_n's and less than or equal to all the b_n's. And it's not too hard to show that these things get closer and closer together. So the least upper bound of the A's is the greatest lower bound of the B's. So this is in all the intervals at the same time, so it avoids all of the X's at the same time. So it really is different from them all. That's how Cantor proved the reals were uncountable. Later on, he thought of his diagonal proof, which uses decimal sequences, which is the more popular one today. Okay, questions or comments? I'm running over time. I have to let you go. I will post the video lectures, and I'll send you an email when